It is a great pleasure for me to be able to introduce Fred to you this evening for various reasons. And there are people in the room, and I'm looking at some of them, who will know what I'm going to say, and some people might not. For me, this is especially meaningful because Fred served as a board member on the advisory board for the Ann Arbor Public Schools that ran and governed the public library when it was part of the public schools. And then he served on the transitional board and was president of that board when the public schools spun the library off and it became a district library. So his involvement with the public library is as important and as meaningful to the community for me as what he's written about for the university. And there will be another book, right?
About, I hope so. Fred,
right, the public library and Fred's involvement. In addition to that, while he's writing this book, and I know was still working at the university some of the time, he served for 6 years on the board of the Friends of the Ann Arbor District Library. And his commitment to the public library is profound and dedicated and consistent. And from my point of view, that's an amazing thing, and I really appreciate that. I want us all to celebrate with Fred this evening the publication of A Setting for Excellence. I told him how much I appreciated the title. I'm a U of M grad, and I love the fact that U of M is about excellence, and it stands for that, and it's committed to that. I'm really pleased about this. I want him to feel welcomed here at the library and University Press also, and they're here in the back selling books for you to purchase and for Fred to sign later. Don't you just love this? Your author signing and everything at the public library. I mean, this is so important and special that a person who works so hard to make sure that the community had such a great institution, it has been for a very long time, now is contributing something to its shelves. That is very, very important, and I'm so grateful. And I welcome Fred Mayer to you all.
Thank you, Josie, and thank you all for coming. I have to admit, when I saw some of the people that arrived, I realized there are people in the audience who know more about some of these subjects than I do. So cut me a little slack if you will, if I, you know, go off on a little tangent. As you may know, I worked for the university in planning for 37 years. And I dealt with many people over the years in terms of the evolution of the campus and the various projects. And it always seemed to me that Michigan people as a whole tended to have their eyes focused on the future more than they did on the past. And that there was a lot of ignorance of some of the history of the institution. And unlike many of our peer institutions where there are numerous books about the development and the evolution of the campus, Michigan never had a comprehensive book dealing with that subject. So I decided that that was my challenge, and I produced the book, which Josie just showed you, and hopefully it will be one that you'll enjoy reading. Now, I don't have enough time to cover everything that's in the book tonight, but I'm going to try and hit a couple of highlights, and hopefully it'll give you an overview of what's in it. There's a couple of things I want to mention just to begin with. The first is, I'm a physical planner. My area of expertise and background is in the built environment, and that is what I'm dealing with in this book. There are many issues in planning for a university that have to do with curriculum and academic programs and financial matters and things like that. But I'm focused on the physical environment, and so that's what this talk will be all about. Second thing I should tell you is that this is primarily focused on the central campus. That's the most historic part of the university, and it's the part with the longest history. I have prepared a manuscript that deals with the medical center and the north campus and the athletic area, but that's in the future. This one and this talk is focused on the central campus. And the third thing I want to mention is that the campus, as a design form, is a unique and distinct form from other parts of the built environment. Campus is an American creation. The first reference to a campus anywhere was at Princeton in the middle of the 18th century. European universities up until the last 20 or 30 years had no idea of a campus as a unifying parcel of land on which the college was built. Their buildings were scattered throughout the city. So this is a design form that's unique to this country, and in my opinion anyway, it's probably the most successful effort to build an environment that's functional, aesthetic, and humane of all of the forms in existence in America. So I'm proud of the whole idea of campus and the role that we as campus planners made to bringing it about. And finally, I will tell you that in my definition of a campus, there are three hallmarks of a well-designed campus. In the first place, there's quality architecture. The buildings, not all of the buildings necessarily, but a significant number of them should represent good quality design. Secondly, there's landscape, open space, and site development. As one of my colleagues said, without landscape, you don't have a campus. And the balance between architecture and landscape is very important in creating an ideal campus image. And the final element is a perceivable sense of order. There's got to be structure and a visual order and harmony that characterizes the campus. If you have these three things, chances are you'll have a campus that people consider well-designed, place they want to be. Now, having said that, let me go back to the beginning and start to describe the evolution of the Michigan campus. It actually started 20 years before Michigan became a state. It was organized in 1817, and we're about to celebrate the bicentennial of that event. It was part of a master plan for education for Michigan Territory, which was devised by the territorial governor, Judge Augustus Woodward, and it was called the Catholicistomiad. It consisted not only of the university, but of primary and secondary education, so it incorporated the full scope of education from the very beginning up through university work. And the university was the capstone of this organization. The university was established in Detroit. There was an administration and a faculty that was created. The Reverend John Monteith, who was a Protestant minister in the city, was the president of the university. Father Gabriel Richard, the priest at St. Anne's Church, was the vice president. There was a curriculum that was created, and those two gentlemen were given responsibility for teaching all of the courses in the curriculum. In addition to that, a building was built. Subscriptions were raised, and a building was built on Bates Street, just north of Larned. It was shown on a number of the early maps of Detroit as one of the prominent buildings of the city, and so there was a physical presence as well as an academic organization for the university in Detroit. However, it was only at this point that anybody bothered to ask whether there were any students in Michigan Territory that were capable of undertaking university-level work. And when the question was asked, the answer was no. So the building was used for the next 20 years intermittently for secondary and primary school purposes. In 1837, Michigan was admitted to the Union, and a new constitution was written for the state. The university was separated from the primary and secondary school functions and organized under a separate board. At the same time, the Ann Arbor Land Company offered the governing board of the university 40 acres of land in Ann Arbor if they would move the university from Detroit to Ann Arbor, which the Regents agreed to do. Now, you might ask yourself, why would the Ann Arbor Land Company do that? Well, it was in order to stimulate the sales of lots which it had laid out on the remainder of the land that it owned. As it turned out, the original developers of Ann Arbor had stimulated the growth of the city by securing its designation of the county seat and building the courthouse down at Huron and Main Street. And so the lots that they owned around it sold very robustly, and they were very successful financially. However, in the late 20s, a gentleman by the name of Anson Brown came to town. He owned the land down in what is called Lower Town, down around Broadway and Maiden Lane, Wall Street, in that area. And he built a mill on the river right there at the where the Broadway Bridge crosses the river. And so his lots began selling, and the ones up in the older part of town weren't moving as fast. So the land company decided if they could lure the university to Ann Arbor, that would be to a spur to the sale of their lots, which, as it turns out, it was, and it was a successful collaboration. When the first meeting of the governing board was held in Ann Arbor in 1837, therefore, there were two major issues dealing with the physical development of the campus that had to be dealt with. The first was selecting a parcel of land for the new campus. The Ann Arbor Land Company had actually offered two different parcels of land. The one on the south, here, is the 40 acres that you know today as the Michigan campus. The one to the north overlooked the river, was probably a more dramatic parcel of land, and it comprised the area where the old St. Joe Hospital used to be and is now owned by the university. The Regents selected the southernmost, probably because it was flat, well-drained land, easy to build on, and had been cleared of the original trees and was then in farmland. But at any rate, that was the parcel that they settled upon. The second decision they had to make was to select an architect to prepare a campus plan and to design the initial building for the university. They selected a gentleman by the name of Alexander Jackson Davis from New York, who was arguably at that time the most prominent architect in the country. And Davis produced a plan for the campus, which is shown here. His concept would be that there would be a major new academic building which would face State Street, which is the street that runs along the bottom. There would be room for growth with additional academic buildings to either side of it, and then a future growth zone around the eastern periphery of the campus. The contract not only called for a major academic and dormitory building, but also four professors' houses. It seems to have been the belief that in order to get educated people to the wilderness, you had to provide them housing. So the university built four professors' houses to lure the faculty out here. The plan also provided for a north-south carriageway through the center of the campus and an east-west pedestrian way focused on the building from the east side. This is East University up here. And then provided for two areas for botanical gardens in the center of the campus. So essentially, there would be a major building facing State Street, and then another group of buildings that would enclose a landscaped courtyard. This is one of the designs that that Davis prepared for that initial building. There were several variations, but as you can see, it would have been a very elegant building designed in the collegiate Gothic style and would be rather similar to the buildings that exist today on the Law Quad. Unfortunately, the whole project came to naught because in those days, the state superintendent of public education had control of the university budget, and he felt the scheme would be entirely too expensive and vetoed it. So it was never built. In its place, the Regents adopted a far more modest plan with a row of smaller buildings facing State Street, which is on this side in this particular plan, that would allow them to be built incrementally over time. They also provided for the four professors' houses that you can see near the center of North University and South University. The central carriageway is still a feature of this plan. It seems that it was put in there under some pressure from the Regents, and fortunately it was never built as the campus evolved. But this was the plan that was adopted by the Regents, and this was the plan that was actually built. The initial construction built the two academic dormitory buildings that were located at the center of that row. There was a space between them that would allow for a future building. In addition, four professors' houses were built on North and South University, as shown on the plan. Now, this is what they looked like in their original form. Only one of them, as a matter of fact, only one of these original buildings remains, and that building is the President's House, which is on South University today. As you can see, there have been many additions, both vertical and to the sides, but I think you can see in the center of the picture the basic architectural character of the initial building. During the period before the Civil War, there were a couple of other buildings added to the campus. A medical school building was added on East University. There is some question about why they went over there, but it seems that in the 1850s, securing cadavers for the medical school was a sort of a questionable endeavor, and people thought maybe it would be a good idea to have that building a little bit removed from the scrutiny of the rest of the campus. There was also a small chemical laboratory, which was one of the first buildings designed on campuses for specific scientific purposes. This is a view of that campus that was done by Jasper Francis Cropsey, a relatively famous painter of the Hudson River School. And you can see what it looked like just before the Civil War. The academic buildings facing State Street are in the background. The medical school building facing on East University is here. You can see the professors' houses at either end. And a little bit of the development which was starting to take place along State Street and North University at the time. You can also get a glimpse of the rather infamous cat hole down in here, which is about where the dental school exists today. As you can see, it was a small-scale college set in a lovely, verdant setting, and it was typical of most of the institutions that existed prior to the Civil War in this country. At this point, there were many, many small colleges spread across the country. The largest institution in the country was William and Mary with 1,000 students, but even institutions like Harvard and Yale and Princeton numbered their enrollments in the hundreds. This was just prior to the Civil War. Now, major wars have a way of changing things, and the Civil War certainly changed this country. We entered as a small agricultural nation. Most of the people lived on farms. Cities were small. Industry was modest. But after the Civil War, we became a major industrializing nation. Immigrants were pouring into the country, so the population was growing. There was relative prosperity in the country. Great fortunes were being made. And there was pressure for institutions of higher education to grow. And that certainly happened at Michigan. In 1863, a building called Haven Hall was built just to the north of one of the original academic buildings, Mason Hall, near the corner of North University and State Street. In 1870, a central element was added between the two original buildings, and they were all linked together as one building that was called University Hall. These were all done pretty much in conformance with the 1840 plan. Whoops, what did I do there? Oh, and at this time, the housing that existed on campus was essentially abolished. The professors' houses were converted to academic use and additions were built. The rooms that had been provided originally for students in the two buildings facing State Street were abolished, and those were converted to academic uses as well. The two professors' houses on North University were turned into hospitals. So at this point, University Hospital, as well as a homeopathic hospital, were actually on the central 40 acres. Other buildings became origins for the dental school and the engineering school. In 1880, a natural history museum was added just to the south of University Hall, again, in conformance with the 1840 plan. So the development of that State Street row took place pretty much in a manner consistent with the planning concept that was developed in the 1840s. But in 1883, when the state finally provided funds for a new library, they looked at the sites that were left on the north and the south end of that row and concluded that there wasn't enough room to build the library. So the architects of the project, Ware and Van Brunt from Boston, suggested that for such an important building on a university campus as a library, it would be appropriate to put it near the center of the central 40 acres, which had now pretty much transformed itself into an academic zone from one side to the other. That was a decision that was a good decision. The 1883 library stood on the campus just about where the Hatcher Library, this picture shows you the row along State Street with Haven Hall, University Hall, and the museum at the far end. So you can see that there was a orderly group of buildings facing State Street. But the 1883 library now moved to the center of the campus, as I say, where the Hatcher Library stands today. Now, that in itself was a pretty good decision, and even today, that's the center of the library complex. But what had happened is that now the campus was beginning to outgrow the 1840 plan, and no new master plan was created to take its place. So for the next 20 years, decisions on siting buildings were made on a project-by-project basis. Each project, if you look at it as a ship on its own bottom, the criteria that were used were rational, the site that was chosen made sense, and you could not call them bad decisions, you couldn't fault the decision-making, but without the benefit of a comprehensive plan, they tended to be unrelated. So that by the 1890s, you had a group of buildings along State Street, which presented a somewhat orderly facade, but when you got away from State Street, the library was here, the rest of the buildings were sort of scattered in a rather haphazard pattern around the campus. This not only was not very attractive physically, but it also didn't provide for a very efficient use of the land. The salvation in terms of the appearance of the campus in these days was the trees. And the trees had an interesting history too. When the campus was first laid out in the 1840s, there were several attempts to plant trees by the university and the city working together, and they failed. The trees died. So when the first professor of history, Andrew Dixon White, arrived in the 1850s, he found the campus to be deplorable looking. And he went around the campus preaching the necessity to plant trees and landscape the campus. And finally, he convinced a number of his students that it was a wise idea, and he made a deal with them. He said, "I'll buy the trees if you'll plant them and take care of them." Well, the students agreed to do that, and the trees were planted, and this time they survived. And even into the 1880s, it was that canopy of trees and landscape that held the campus together. Now, this pattern of planless development was not unique to Michigan in this era. If you read people's comments on the Harvard campus or the Yale campus or a number of other older institutions at this point, you find similar things going on. And in our cities, too, the quality of the environment in the post-Civil War era was deteriorating badly. I mean, it was the era when Pittsburgh had the streetlights on at noon on a clear day because there was so much air pollution. Or the Chicago River had what was left over from the stockyards floating out into Lake Michigan. It was a pretty dismal prospect, and people were fleeing the cities. But in 1893, an event took place which changed things dramatically. This was the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago. It was planned as the 400th anniversary of Columbus's discovery of the New World, but anyone who can do math will realize they missed by a year. However, they succeeded in another respect. The planning and design of the grounds were entrusted to the best, some of the best architects and landscape architects available in the world at that point. And what they did was put together a plan for the fair on what is now Jackson Park, south of the Loop in Chicago. And it created a well-organized group of buildings around two lagoons, a formal lagoon shown here, which could be accessed from behind me from Lake Michigan. There was a pier where you could come by steamer from downtown Chicago. And then this linked under the bridge to an informal lagoon where Olmsted created a wooded island. The buildings themselves were built in gleaming white. It was a temporary material, but it looked like marble. They were built mostly in the classical style of architecture, and there was a beauty and harmony to the complex which convinced people that a well-planned environment could indeed produce a beautiful setting, and as well as a functional one, even in a place like America. If you are interested in going over to Chicago, there's a replica of the sculpture, which got nicknamed Big Mary, although its formal title was the Statue of the Republic. And you can still find the wooded island. But the fair itself set off a wave of interest in planning in this country, which became known as the City Beautiful Movement, and led to the adoption for master plans for most of the major cities around the United States, as well as an enthusiasm for replanning on campuses. But as Michigan entered the 20th century, it was becoming clear that the development of the campus had now consumed almost all of the buildable sites, and that something would have to be done. So the Regents adopted a three-part strategy. The first part had to do with getting off of the campus those activities that weren't key to the primary academic mission. So land was acquired on South State Street, and the intercollegiate athletic fields were moved off of the Central 40 down to the State Street area. Another parcel of land was acquired with the assistance of the city of Ann Arbor up on Catherine Street, and the hospitals were moved from the Central 40 up to what we now know as the Medical Center. A second aspect of this plan was the fact that the university began to acquire land outside the Central 40 acres, which would enable it to grow beyond the initial grant of land which had served them for the entire 19th century. And the third part of the strategy was the rebuilding of the Central Campus. Most of the buildings on the Central Campus were built in ways that looked okay from the outside, but on the inside were entirely wood construction. They were not fireproof. There was not safe exiting that was provided, and a number of them were becoming obsolete for their original purpose. The first buildings that were built in the 20th century were the West Medical Building, which is now known as the Dana Building. It was built just north of the original medical school building on what had been the playing fields. And the second building was the West Engineering Building, which is now known as West Hall, down at South University and East University on a site that had been for a short time botanical gardens and then a smaller building, which was an anatomy building that served the medical school. But that essentially consumed the remaining large buildable sites on the Central Campus. So at this point, the Regents created a committee to develop a new master plan for the university. The committee contained people like Dean Mortimer Cooley and Professor Francis Kelsey, but the leader of the committee was Emil Lorch, who was the first dean of the architecture school. And Lorch proposed a plan, which is shown here, which essentially called for rebuilding the campus with a number of new buildings facing out on the periphery, but also defining the central open space of the campus, which was to become what we know today as the Diag. He called for preservation of the central walkway that dated back to the origin of the campus, the diagonal walk itself, and another complementary axis running in the from the northeast to the southwest. He also suggested that a new entrance to the campus should be created off of North University on the north-south axis running through the Central Library. These concepts were good concepts, but the plan was not officially adopted by the Board of Regents because they were afraid it would commit them to a level of expenditure that they didn't know how they were going to raise the money for. However, it had an impact on the location of several buildings which were important to the future development of the campus. The 1908 chemistry building, which is shown here, was placed in accordance with the plan. And the 1916 natural science building, which would go on this site, also was placed in the similar manner. And that created the north-south entrance to the campus that Lorch proposed and which would later be extended to become the Ingalls Mall. This is a perspective of his concept. This is the North University edge with the entrance shown here, the central open space of the Diag, and the building developments surrounding it to enclose a central quadrangle. You can see the natural science building, chemistry building on the far side, and that entry that Lorch proposed as it exists today. Next in this period, we had several buildings that began to expand the campus outside the central 40 acres. In 1912, Hill Auditorium was constructed across North University from the central 40 acres and began the development of an area to the north of the original campus. The Michigan Union was built in 1919 west of the original central 40 acres across State Street, began the development of that area. Other buildings like Martha Cook, which was across South University, began the development of the southern area. So you had the campus beginning to expand beyond the limits of the central 40 acres. In 1916, the Olmsted Brothers firm was hired by the city of Ann Arbor to develop a plan for parks and parkways in the city. The university figured as long as we had a distinguished planning firm in town, we'd ask for their ideas with respect to the growth of the central campus. This is the plan that Olmsted produced. As it turns out, it was not particularly well related to the academic programs of the university, but it began to think about the growth outside of the original core and began to get people thinking about how we ought to handle that aspect of university development. Now, in 1920, we got a new president by the name of Marion Leroy Burton. Burton was a very dynamic and exciting leader for the university. And he believed that the university had an obligation to meet the needs of the state in terms of higher education. At this point, the automobile industry was growing rapidly, the population of the state was growing along with it, and the prosperity of the state mirrored both of them. Burton felt that as the demand for higher education in Michigan was growing, that the university should grow to accommodate it. And he also felt that that growth could take place without sacrificing the quality of education that Michigan had become known for. And so in order to provide for that, he did two things. The first was he developed a new master plan, which is the one that's shown here. And as you can see, this encompasses a much larger vision than anything before it. This is the central 40 acres, but now he's showing growth to the south, to the north, to the east, and the west. This plan was developed along the lines of what was called the Beaux-Arts approach to planning. Got that name from the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris, where many of the architects in that era had been trained. But it called for the grouping of a number of buildings and organizing them around axes of development and relating the buildings one another in a compatible architectural manner, as well as the development of the campus around plazas and landscaped areas. This is all incorporated into this plan. You can see it built on the idea of the central open space of the Diag, but it took the idea of the north entrance and expanded it to a mall, which would extend north-south from the general library. The mall at this point extends even further than it does today, going all the way to Ann Street on the north, the thought being that Ann Street would then serve as a connector to the medical center. It also incorporated a number of movement axes across the campus, the original Diag, and another axis here, which would move to the northeast, continue out through the block that now contains the medical, the dental school, and link up to the medical center. In addition to that, the planning in this era relied heavily on the role of architecture in providing a harmonious appearance to the campus. And so you'll see the buildings are shown in rather detailed footprints. And the architects in this era were trained to think in terms of the overall environment, to realize that they had an obligation in designing a new building to relate to the buildings that were there and to make these all fit within an overall master plan. And so you'll see that the shapes of many of the buildings that appear here are reflections of the buildings that actually got built. Angel Hall, which came in here, these were the two original buildings. But even somewhat arbitrary forms like the Ruthven Museum and the C.C. Little are very close to the actual form of the building that got built, because architecture was considered to play a vital role in establishing a harmonious and attractive campus. Now, beyond doing the planning, President Burton was also a very effective speaker and was able to excite people about his vision. And he went to Lansing to the legislature and convinced the legislature that they ought to appropriate money for a number of new buildings that the university needed to carry out the plan. There were two major appropriations in 1921 and 1923, and with them, a number of major building projects were underway. This is an aerial photograph of the campus at about 1924, and you can begin to see the impact that that program was having. Angel Hall is under construction facing State Street. The Clements Library is under construction facing South University. East Engineering was under construction here, as was Randall Lab. The site was being cleared for the C.C. Little building, and a few years later, the Ruthven Museum would take place on this particular parcel. So the whole era was referred to as the Burton Building Boom, because there was so much construction going on the campus. Unfortunately, President Burton died of a heart attack in 1925, and so the number of new buildings that were begun after that began to decline, because his successor was more interested in curriculum reform than he was in construction. But nonetheless, there were a number of buildings that were built in this period, beginning with the Graduate Library, which replaced the 1883 library essentially on the same site, Angel Hall, which faced State Street, C.C. Little Building over on East University. But in addition to the publicly funded buildings, it was also a time when the university succeeded in attracting a number of major private gifts. The Clements Library was built on South University at this time. Other buildings like Cousins Hall and the Simpson Institute. And of course, the Law Quad was begun with the buildings of the Lawyers Club and the dormitories in the 1920s. Hutchins Hall and the Legal Research Building were finished in the 1930s. But nonetheless, it was an era of tremendous construction on the campus and growth and expansion. Now, that all came to an end, or not quite an end, but it slowed down dramatically after 1929 with the stock market crash and the economic depression. But there were a couple of major projects that were built in the 1930s. The first was Burton Tower. After the untimely death of President Burton, it was suggested a memorial should be built to honor him. And throughout his career, he had campaigned to have a campanile built, a bell tower on campus. At one point, he even had it included in the design for Angel Hall. But it had never taken place. So the university secretary, Shirley Smith, suggested that it would be appropriate to build such a structure in his honor. After his death in the 20s, the distinguished Finnish architect, Eliel Saarinen, who had come over to this country and was a professor at the university, agreed to work with Albert Kahn to develop a concept for it. This concept was then made part of a fundraising campaign, which was moving along well until the Depression hit. Well, it took until the middle of the 1930s that they were able to get together enough money to proceed with the project. And even then, modifications had to be made to the design of the tower, shortening it somewhat. Also, Saarinen had become the director of the Cranbrook Institution, so the Kahn firm continued on with the building. So if you look at the working drawings for the project, it's listed as Albert Kahn Associates. But it was actually a result of a collaboration between two great architects. And this was built in the 1930s and is one of the symbolic structures of the university campus. Another one from this era was the Rackham Building, which was a gift from the Horace Rackham Foundation. It became the headquarters of the graduate school. You can see it was designed in the Art Deco style of that period, but it has a monumentality of it that really seems appropriate to the northern end of the mall. The siding of this building fixed the north end of the Ingalls Mall, and so it completed the definition of the extremities of the mall. You can also see the Millis Fountain out here in front of the League, which was added in 1940 and has become another landmark on the campus. This is a photograph of the central campus in 1942. It shows you what was going on in terms of the transformation of the campus. It's interesting because you can see Angel Hall here facing State Street, but you can also see University Hall immediately behind it. It was still in existence at the time. Here's Haven Hall, the old Natural History Museum, which had become the Romance Languages Building, and the Alumni Memorial Hall. But you also see older buildings on campus, the West Physics Building, which was in here between Clements and the Graduate Library, the Engineering Shops Building, which are holdovers from the 19th century. But then you see new buildings like West Engineering, the Dana Building, Chemistry, Natural Science. So you get a sense of the campus, which has got 1 foot in the 19th century buildings and 1 foot in the new 20th century buildings. During the war, there was no construction whatsoever. All of the efforts were put into the war effort and construction came to a halt. But after the war, construction resumed. The first buildings that were erected after the war were done pretty much in conformance with the concept of the Burton Plan. It was still a Beaux-Arts kind of concept, and early buildings like the additions to East Engineering Building, the addition to the Chemistry Building, just followed along in that. But as time went by into the 50s, we began to reach a dilemma because in the first place, we were beginning to move into sites that had never been anticipated in the older plan. But perhaps more importantly, a major change took place in the concept of architecture. The modernist movement now had become the dominant approach to architecture. And the modernist movement was seeking to create a new architecture entirely oriented to the industrial age of the 20th century. They really rejected the concepts of the past. They didn't want any ornamentation on buildings. and they felt that most of the older buildings really ought to be torn down and replaced by new buildings. They promised that this was going to lead to a wonderful new modern environment which would make things better for everyone. But in terms of campus planning, it created the dilemma that whereas in the 20s, we relied on architecture as a major factor in providing campus harmony, now each building was treated by the architect as a ship on its own bottom. And while they might choose to relate to the older buildings, there was no guarantee. So you couldn't rely on architecture as strongly as a unifying element. In this environment, the university decided it was time to create a new campus plan. And in 1963, they called upon the consulting firm of Johnson, Johnson & Roy to assist in the development of that kind of a plan. And we started to ask ourselves, well, if you couldn't rely as strongly on architecture, were there things you could look to? And the consultants began by looking at the historical development of the campus and identifying features that were unique to the environment of the Michigan campus that might help to create a framework for future growth. And one of the first things, of course, in Michigan is that we're a campus that has grown up as part of the city, closely related to the city. This is this space where Haven Hall used to stand, it burned down in 1950, is a prime example because here you have university buildings on two sides of an open space and city buildings on the other two sides. It provides a positive, exciting, interactive space, but it also is symbolic of that interrelationship between the campus and the community that we have here at Michigan. Other factors that they identified were the walkway system. You remember the Diag goes back to the pre-Civil War era, and the importance of moving about campus on foot for students and faculty was a factor that had tied things together. Open space, although in 1963 much of it was not well defined. We had the Diag and the Law Quad, but the rest of it was a bit amorphous. Still, the trees, dating back again to the pre-Civil War period, were an important element that helped to hold the campus together and provide a humane environment. There were other elements. The organizational pattern of the campus as it moved from the central 40 acres had developed a series of individual precincts on each side of it. So you had one to the north, to the south, east, and west. And they each had a unique character and quality to them. You had, of course, the vehicular transportation system, which particularly after World War II with the growth of the automobile, became increasingly important. And then you had parking and other elements like that. And so these things were summarized into a series of elements that might contribute to the development of a new campus framework. Now, after that was done, the consultants sat down with the university and said, now, what is it that you would like to see the campus become? And people told them about how they would like to have a more pedestrian-oriented core. They'd like to eliminate the conflicts between traffic and pedestrians. They'd like to have a greener campus with more emphasis on landscaping and site development and a number of other elements. They'd like the traffic to be rerouted to the edge of the campus and people get out of their cars at the edge and walk through the pedestrian core. So these things were combined with the historical evolution of the campus, and an overall concept was presented, which is done in a rather loose form in this sketch. But what it amounted to was that it recognized the organizational pattern by creating a series of open spaces, signature open spaces for each one of the campus precincts. Those would be tied together with a continuous and well-designed walkway system, which would then extend out to link with the surrounding community. That vehicular traffic would be rerouted to the edge of the campus. Parking structure, a ring of parking structures would be built around the edge where people could leave their cars and then walk in the core of the campus. and a pedestrian-oriented core would be developed. And then to carry that out with a little more specificity, for each one of the campus precincts, a more detailed set of recommendations was presented in terms of how the campus should grow in terms of the open space system, in terms of the pedestrian system. Building sites were identified, as for example here north of Hill Auditorium, but there was no attempt made to show a specific architectural footprint. That would be left when the project became real and you knew what the program would be, you knew what the budget would be, you knew who the architect would be that would be designing it, and he would bring his ideas to the table and fit into the developable site. Now, with the plan in mind, then, we needed to test its viability in the implementation process. The first opportunity came in the area which is now known as the Regents Plaza. This is a view of the Regents Plaza in the early 60s. It wasn't a plaza, it was just a surface parking lot. You can see the Thompson Street parking structure in the background, West Quad over there. There had been a concept in the master plan. There was a project to build a new administration building. Originally, it had been conceived of as going directly adjacent to the old administration building, which is now known as the LS&A building. But when we looked at it more closely, it was realized that if you move this building to the back, to the west edge of this block, and you could create the new plaza in the center where it would function far more effectively in terms of pedestrian movement through the zone. And that, of course, is what was done. This is the Fleming Administration Building on the west edge along Thompson Street. The plaza in the center with the landscaping and development and the pedestrian movement through the middle of it. And we also were able to add a focal element in the plaza itself, which was the cube that was designed by Bernard Rosenthal, who was an alumnus of the university and a leading American sculptor, and provided a finishing touch to the Regents Plaza, which is one of the more popular pieces of sculpture on campus because the students can spin it. At the same time, an addition was being planned to the graduate library. One of the principles of the plan had been to protect the pedestrian movement across the campus. There was, before this building was erected, a major walkway that ran across here. And the problem with using the site for the library addition was that it would block the walkway. But the solution that was arrived at was to lift the building one story, protect the walkway underneath it, and also to develop the area between the graduate library and the Clements Library as a landscape plaza, the so-called Library South Plaza, which was implemented in conjunction with this building. In the early 1970s, we built the Power Center adjacent to Felch Park. There was a first design of the building that would have actually removed a lot of the trees in the park, but we opted in favor for a design that would put the new building behind the park, using reflective glass, which would increase the image of the greenery, preserve and define the open space, while at the same time accommodating the theater building. Now, in 1980, another change took place in the approach to architecture. Starting in the late 60s and 70s, a number of critics had begun pointing out the fact that the modernist school was not exactly producing that wonderful environment that everybody would feel good about, and that in fact there were a number of shortcomings to many of the modern buildings. Not all of them, of course. Some of them were outstanding, but some of them left something to be desired. And this movement, which was led by a writer in the name of Tom Wolfe and the architect Robert Venturi, suggested that there were good things in the older buildings and that we ought not reject them automatically, and that the idea of using traditional forms and materials, even though you might use them in a contemporary way, was not a bad idea. The first building on campus to incorporate that concept was the Alumni Center, which Hugh Jacobson designed and was built in the early 80s. And you can see here, although it's clearly a modern building, the architect chose to relate strongly to the materials and elements in the adjacent Michigan League building. And it produced a building that fit very harmoniously into this zone of the campus, as well as defining the eastern, the northeastern side of the Ingalls Mall. Another building of this philosophy was Carl Luckenbach's small addition to Tappan Hall on South University, which, although functionally it wanted to be a blank brick box, the architect adopted motifs from the original Tappan Hall, as well as a number of other buildings along South University, and very sensitively solved the functional problem of protecting the library materials stored in here, but still producing a building that was aesthetically pleasing from South University. In the early 80s, Dean Whitaker became the new dean of the business school, and he set out on a project to greatly enlarge the facilities of the business school. A master plan for the complex was developed. JJNR did the landscaping, and Luckenbach-Ziegelman did the architecture. It retained at that point the 1948 building, built a new library, a computer DME building, and an executive residence. A new parking structure was added, counting center, and an auditorium wing. As I say, the landscape plan was developed by JJNR, and it preserved one of the 100-year-old bur oak trees on the campus, as well as presenting a space which could be used by the people in the executive residence for outdoor dining in decent weather. In 1987, the 1963 plan had been in existence and functioning for almost 25 years. And so it was decided that we ought to take another look and see what needed to be done in terms of updating the plan. Again, JJNR was asked to undertake the task, which they did. The conclusion that was arrived at was the basic principles underlying the 63 plan were still valid and working effectively. There were some new concepts that needed to be incorporated into this plan, like historic preservation and the addition of public art on the campus. But basically, this was a refinement and update of the concepts of the 1963 plan, not a radical change from that concept. But there were two projects that had been called for in 63 that had not yet been completed. The first of these was the Ingalls Mall. Now, this concept had been around since back in President Burton's day, but it had not been completely implemented. We started with, when the Alumni Center was finished, to convert the northern end. The city vacated the western edge of Ingalls Street, and we were able to convert that into a pedestrian way. And through the course of the 1980s, we continued moving southward with the conversion until in 1989, we finally finished the section between the chemistry building and the natural science building. And here you can see the completed project extending from the flagpole on the diag here north to the Rackham building. And at ground level, standing on the steps of the graduate library, it is still the active, exciting heart of the campus, but it now had a landscaped image that was appropriate for such an important space. We had another project which was of interest both architecturally and planning-wise. When it was obvious that we needed to provide additional space on the undergraduate library, which was known as the Ugly. Most people forgot that Ugly was actually a shortening of undergraduate library. They thought it was simply a description of the building. But in expanding it, we were able to essentially wrap the new building around the old building and radically transform the image of the building in a way that allowed it to relate much more positively to the surrounding architecture. And I recall standing out in front of it one day, and a couple of students came by, and one of them said to the other, "Oh my God, would you look? They made the ugly beautiful." In the mid-1990s, the addition to the physics building was added on the east side of the campus, which provided a strong definition to the eastern wall. Although the Diag had been around for a long time and most sides of it were relatively well-defined architecturally, the east side, until this building was inserted, remained sort of the back ends of buildings like West Engine and Randall Lab. But this building gave it an architectural facade which blended with the architecture of the Diag itself. Again, it was designed by Carl Luckenbach. And that gave us the opportunity to renovate the Diag. Now, in the case of the Diag, it was not necessary to make radical changes. There were some changes that needed to be made because there were still walkways out there that led to the front door of buildings that had been torn down 20 years ago. So we needed to revise the walkway pattern. But mainly what we needed to do was correct the drainage, loosen the soil, provide for aeration, add additional trees where they were needed, and generally upgrade the space. That was accomplished in the mid-90s in conjunction with the projects at the Undergraduate Library and the Randall Lab. And you can see that the new pattern of walkways related now to the buildings as they existed on the Diag, yet preserved the essential quality of the Diag, which had been known and admired by Michigan students for a long period. The final project was the conversion of East University to a pedestrian way. This was another idea that went back almost to the days of the Burton Plan, but it was certainly an important one in terms of the central campus plan. It was an area of intense student use between academic buildings, yet it remained as a sort of a not very functional street. It was more of a linear parking lot, and it was certainly an unattractive area. In 1997, we were finally able to move ahead with the plans to convert that to a pedestrian way, and today it's a landscaped area at the heart of the campus, which provides signature space for this science complex of buildings on the east side. The last thing I want to touch upon is the fact that over the years, we've built a rather impressive collection of public art on the campus. The first thing that you might consider a piece of public art was the Professor's Monument, which was built in the pre-Civil War era. And then buildings, a number of buildings incorporated sculpture on the facade. Martha Cook has a sculpture of Portia over the door, and there are several in the Union. The Pumas in front of the Ruthven Library are one of the earlier pieces on campus. Also, the fountain on the Ingalls Mall I showed you a while ago. The Lady of the Garden came in the 1960s in the Martha Cook courtyard. The Jennifer piece near the on the South University side of the Art Museum, the Holocaust Memorial in the area adjacent to the Rackham Building, and of course, recently the De Suvero piece, which stands in front of the addition to the Art Museum and makes it clear what the function of that building is all about. So today, the campus that exists really incorporates the concepts that were first explored in the 63 plan, but elements that date back really to the very beginnings of the Michigan campus. It is, I think, a harmonious blend of predominantly quality architecture, a generous pattern of open space with a number of signature spaces, including the Regents Plaza, the Law Quad, the Diag, East University, the Ingalls Mall, Felch Park, and organized in a perceivable manner which ties the whole campus together. I think it's a mature campus which has realized the objectives that we had in terms of achieving harmony and beauty as well as functionality on the campus. The challenge that lies before us is universities are always changing, and things will have to change in the future. And how we change will be a great question. The campus is pretty completely developed, so we'll have to face the issue of, do we buy more land? Do we tear down existing buildings to make way for new ones? Do we consume open space? Do we move units to North Campus? These are all challenges for the future. But hopefully, the university will have the wisdom to continue to develop a harmonious campus along the lines of the framework system, which was developed in the latter part of the 20th century. So I think with that, I will stop and entertain questions from the audience.
And if anyone has a question, just raise your hand and I'll come around with the mic. Okay, we have one right here in just a second.
Given the honorable legacy of a lot of beautiful artistic buildings, how did the Regents approve the horror of the thing behind the Power Center? I think it's a biosciences building. It said it puts one in mind of post-war Soviet Poland.
I have never spoken for the Regents, and I don't think I'm going to do that now. It's been 12 years since I retired. I might have had some insights into the thinking that went behind a particular design when I was active on the campus and could give you a more useful answer. But I've been away for things for more than a decade, and I really don't know what they had in mind in terms of that building. And sorry, that wasn't a really good answer, but it's the best I can do.
Anyone else? Okay, we have one right over here, just a second.
You mentioned the collaboration of Albert Kahn and
Eliel Saarinen, yeah.
Yes, two at that time very notable and successful architects.
Right.
Isn't that unusual in the world of architecture for two stars to share the spotlight?
It's unusual but not unheard of. Mies van der Rohe and Philip Johnson joined to design the Seagram Building in New York, and there have been similar collaborations, but it's not common. I mean, it was a happy coincidence. Now, I will say that everything I know about the character of Albert Kahn would suggest he was a wonderful person to work with, and it would have been a smooth collaboration. I don't know that much about Mr. Saarinen's personality, but I know Kahn was instrumental in bringing Saarinen to this country in the first place, and they seem to have a good relationship.
Another question here.
Fred, in the middle of the story,
yeah,
you talked about the northern edge of the campus being Ann Street, and then the Rackham Building instead was placed at the northern end,
right,
at Huron Street.
Right.
What debate occurred that caused the Rackham Building to go to Huron Street as opposed to several more blocks north?
Well, the story I heard was that President Ruthven was adamant about placing it there. Now, I think it was probably a pretty wise decision, because if you look at the proportions of the Ingalls Mall and compare it to the proportions of, let's say, the lawn at the University of Virginia, which most people consider to be one of the most exquisite designs for a campus in the country, they're almost the same. Extending it further might have been pushing the limits. But if you look at it, if you look at going north of Huron Street, we didn't own the property at the time. We don't own the property today. I'm not sure we'll ever own the property. So that was problem number one. And I think that it would have forced the Rackham Building into some other site, and I can't even tell you where offhand they might have put it, but it certainly would not have been in as advantageous a position. I mean, not only is it, in my opinion, aesthetically appropriate, but if you think of the symbolism of having the library at one end and the graduate school at the other end, that's probably a pretty accurate reflection of the University of Michigan.
Is that the northern edge of the original 40 acres?
No, the North University was the northern edge originally.
Okay. Thank
you. Someone else? Anybody? Okay, we have one right. Everyone's making me run around.
I'm glad I don't have to do it.
Fred, that was amazing. Thank you. I have a question about architecture as well. It seems that Carl Lickenbach had a great deal of opportunity in some of the buildings around campus, mm-hmm. and how did it happen that Carl Lickenbach was selected to do so much in that central part of campus at period in time?
Although he's done a number of buildings, nobody can match the record of Albert Kahn for the number of buildings they've done on campus. But you've have a number of buildings that have been done by firms like Albert Kahn and Smith Hinchman and Grills, or Smith Group as they're now called, and some others. But actually, the Lickenbach firm started working at the University of Michigan when Carl's father was the principal in charge of the firm. And he did a little building up in the medical center, which is the Victor Vaughan House, which was an intern's residence, I believe, originally. And it's still there along Glen Street, just west of the Taubman Library. But then in the 50s and early 60s, the firm of Odell, Hewlett, and Lickenbach did a number of the parking structures on campus, so they had built a reputation. And Carl went off on his own. It seems to me the first project we had with him was the business school. And I you know, everybody was saying, well, we ought to give him a chance because he's a pretty talented guy. We weren't exactly sure, and that was kind of a big undertaking. But actually, I think he performed very nicely on that. And yeah, and then he built on a rather successful track record at the business school, and he was entrusted with some other projects, as I showed you, Tappan Hall, which was really a small project but a very important one. President Shapiro took a real interest in that because it faced on South University. You think about South University, you got the Museum of Art, the Law School, the Clements Library. You know, there were some very distinguished buildings, and the president wanted to make sure that whatever we put on South University was not an embarrassment to the quality of the buildings up and down the space, and I think Carl responded very well. So I think he proved his way by his performance in designing the various buildings that were given to him.
Anyone else? Well, if not, we want to thank Fred for coming.
Thank you very much.